morning. Welcome to the Senate Judiciary Committee. Today is the 25th of April, Tuesday. It's now 8:40 a.m. Senator Huggins, Senator French, myself, Senator Seekins. The other senators will join us shortly. We're now under the 24-hour rule, which means that basically our intensity everywhere around the building starts to increase, which means also that sometimes our schedules will get very hectic. And so we're going to go for a very short session this morning for about an hour, and then we're going to so we'll try to fit some things in here into the hour as tightly as we can. Representative Lynn, I'm going to start with your bill, House Bill 308. So, Representative Lynn, welcome to Judiciary Committee this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and honorable members of the committee. My name is Representative Bob Lynn, District 31, South Anchorage. It's a pleasure to be here this morning. I'd like to warn everybody right now, you'd better be careful when you check your name a number on your telephone caller ID, because it could be a phony. It could be a prank. Caller ID could say President Bush or Sharon Stone or maybe even Elvis Presley. Now it might be irritating, might even be funny, and it's not that dangerous. Not like you'd cause a major problem. But there is indeed an ominous and a very dark side to a phony name on your caller ID. A child molester could be calling your kids, and the name on the caller ID could be that of a trusted person, or the caller ID may indicate the police or the school or your doctor's office when it's not. This is scary stuff. For those of us in public office or campaigning for election, some bad actor could use our name on the caller ID and send out a political message that destroys your good reputation. For example, Congressman Tim Murphy, who testified in one of the House committees before this bill was heard, had all kind of messages go out to his constituents, totally misrepresenting his position on everything, and the caller ID gave his name and his office telephone number. The power to create serious mischief, the caller ID spoofing technology is almost unlimited. From simple pranks, to spying, to telemarketing and fraud, to enticing victims to dangerous locations for rape or murder. And there's two kinds of caller ID spoofing, commercial spoofing operations that originate in other states and even other nations. These commercial operations advertise their nefarious services all over the internet. Some example of that in your packet. These out-of-state commercial operations are basically a problem facing the FCC, Federal Communications Commission, and the FBI, and there's not much we can do about that here in Alaska except to publicize the threat, which we're doing today. But on the other hand, Alaska can take a small but very essential step to combat the problem, a proactive step. And that's what this bill is all about. The technology and programming that enables caller ID spoofing is fairly simple to anyone in Alaska who is a computer geek and maybe telephone savvy. Such an Alaskan could, in fact, set up a commercial spoofing operation here. That's possible. But more likely, such a person could conduct a private spoofing operation that could mirror commercial spoofing operations and thereby mirror the dangers of spoofing from outside Alaska. This is the person this bill is aimed at. Actually, a person doesn't even have to be that computer savvy. As a matter of fact, you can purchase a spoofer calling ID card and insert it in their caller ID system here. This bill, HB 308, makes a Class B misdemeanor. This means they can be imprisoned for up to 90 days for any person who inserts false information into one of these caller ID systems, except for legitimate law enforcement agencies and national security agencies. This is a simple measure before you. It doesn't get into the technological complexity of exactly how the spoofing gets from the hand of the culprit to display on your caller ID. With this bill simply, if you insert a false caller ID in your ID system, however you do it, a crime has been committed. And therefore, your support of this timely and, I think, proactive cutting-edge legislation is respectfully requested.
Thank you. Any questions for the sponsor? Senator French.
Thanks. Good morning, Representative Lynn. Nice to see you this morning. Any caller ID spoofing going on here in Alaska?
Probably, but I don't have evidence of it. I have no knowledge of it, but whenever a crime can be committed, somebody's probably doing it someplace, even though they've not been apprehended or made the media.
And just to follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
You've checked, of course, with the Consumer Protection Attorney Generals and some local law enforcement officers. I mean, it's just not your own personal knowledge you're representing here. You've done some looking into this.
I have not, but as a matter of fact, no law has been broken anyway, because there is no law.
Go ahead, Senator French.
I understand that, but you know, my question is: have you been contacted by the Attorney General or one of his agents or any law enforcement folks saying, you know, we're seeing that domestic violence victims are being abused this way, or our customers are being defrauded this way, or you know, misrepresentations are happening, you know, out in the community?
No, sir. I'm not. The genesis of this bill is,
did you get this letter?
He's got something here. I'll let him address the genesis of this. Basically, you know, I follow a lot of computer things in my own personal life and even legislative life, and this came to my attention. I thought, wow, this is a dangerous thing, and I investigated from there. And my assistant here, Dirk Moffitt, has a letter here.
Well, in your packet, there's a
For the record,
Dirk Moffitt, staffer for Representative Bob Lynn, the chair. There's a letter we got from the Alaskan Network for Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, and they, when they found out about what we were trying to do, they really saw this as something that could help protect women in these type of cases. So they did. They sent us, but we really, what it was is Bob. He heard this. You know, he saw the potential of this being a problem, and we really didn't. We really did not check with any other agencies to see if it has been a problem. But we see it as something that could be in the future. And right now, if Alaska passes this law, we'll be one of only two states, or only a second state in the country, New York being the other. So it's sort of a new thing. And just to give you an idea of how easy it is to do this caller spoofing, anyone here could buy a card, calling card, and you call into the, you call, it's called a spoof card, and you can call into a call center, just like you do with a calling card, put in the phone number that you want to appear on the other side, the name that you want to appear on this side, and then what voice do you want to have? Do you want to be a male or a female? So you can change your voice. So not only can you fool the caller ID, you can fool the person into thinking you're a female. And that's, and that's a $10 calling card that you can buy online. And that's how easy it is. You don't have to have any special roles, really have any special skills anymore to do it.
Just go ahead, Senator French.
And I'm a big supporter of the Alaska Network, of course, and so their support for the bill is persuasive to me, and I appreciate you bringing it to us. And I'm just curious about what about someone who wants to protect their identity, someone who wants to make a phone call and not reveal to the other side who it is that's calling, or where they might be located, or what their phone number is.
Well, they
is.
Do have that in the services that you can order through through your phone company, that when you call somebody and you don't want them to see it, it'll just say no number. But what we're trying to stop is someone from saying Bank of America, and that can easily happen. And people see Bank of America or in Alaska USA, and you see that on your caller ID, and someone's asking you questions, and you think, well, that's the phone company saying this is who this is.
Also, there is an exception in the bill for law enforcement agencies who could use this in their investigations and national security.
Thank you. That's all the questions I have, Mr. Chairman.
Other questions? Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Lynn. I guess my question is a little different in the respect that people that are trying to disparage one of us, all right, for whatever reason, how easy would that be able to do, and then after that, if you visit the term willfully and what that really means, as far as, because I noticed the term willfully, but please.
I believe it. If you put false information into this, into the telephone caller ID, however you, whether you disparage or do otherwise, or even run your campaign for you in a positive manner, it was false information.
Right.
That's the crime. Not specifically what you put on the message, just to put false information in there.
Okay, and how easy is that to Dirk to do to your phone system?
Very easy if you buy one of these cards to do it, and most anybody, and I don't have the knowledge to do it. I think in a few days I could get the knowledge to do it if I wanted to spend the time at it. Right. As I understand it, and don't tie me down on this, has a lot to do with the VOIP, voice over IP technology.
Yeah, I guess if it's easy to do, my question is how detectable is to be able to determine that Dirk did it and not you? You follow my logic?
I follow your logic.
Through the chair, it would be very difficult to catch these people. That's a granted. I mean, yeah. If they're doing it with a calling card, it's going to be very difficult to catch them. I suppose what would happen is if they were caught doing another crime and you had evidence that they used one of these cards or through the investigation this was found out, then the police could use this as something they could prosecute on. But it'd be very difficult to catch someone doing this.
I understand. But on the other hand, if they're abusing Representative Lynn's telephone, is it easy to ensure that he's not fixed with the crime for changing your phone identity?
Well, it would not emanate from my phone. It would emanate from somebody else's phone.
It would just appear that it was coming from Bob's phone.
Yeah, no, I understand. But which means you can go to somebody, to another system and interdict your phone.
I would suppose so.
Yeah. I'm just trying to see how detectable it is and how easy it is to abuse and for you to be victimized and claiming that you did it when, in fact, somebody else didn't. You know, how enforceable the provisions are. But do you feel comfortable that we can?
I feel comfortable.
Okay.
We don't do perfect laws because we're not perfect people. But it's a proactive step in the right direction. The Congress is, in fact, looking at this very same thing at a national level. And Congressman Tim Murphy, who had this happen to him, he is encouraging all the 50 states to enact legislation of this type as a help to whatever federal legislation they come up with.
Right.
Yeah, it's an evolving thing.
Right. But this would not prohibit people from zeroing out their identification. If you did not want to be identified where your phone call is originating from, it does not zero
no,
that
no,
out.
No, it would not.
Okay.
Well, Representative Lynn, here in Juneau, when I'm here and I want to do a personal long-distance phone call, I use a calling card. And on the other end, it shows a number that's calling that's not the number I'm calling from has to do with the calling card. Is that going to be a violation of the law?
I wouldn't think so because it's not really false information. You're not trying to impersonate somebody.
Okay. Other questions? We only have one person that wants to testify on the bill. It's somebody named Rob Douglas from privacytoday.com. Mr. Douglas, are you there?
I am. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and it's a pleasure to appear here this morning to testify before your committee.
If you'll identify yourself for the record, sir, we'll be eager to hear your testimony.
Sure. My name is Robert Douglas. I'm an information security consultant. I operate a website called privacytoday.com. My background is about 22 years as a private investigator in Washington, D.C., doing everything from political corruption to international terrorism. And for about the last 6 or 7 years, I have worked as a consultant, an information security consultant, testified 7 times before the United States Congress, both on the House and Senate side. The last 2 times, just this past February, specifically on obtaining phone records through means of deception, and at that time, in that testimony, I raised the issue of caller ID spoofing, and that was sort of what got the ball rolling across the country. My expertise is in the use of deception, both social engineering, which is by means of just verbal or written communications, deceiving people as to who someone else is, and also in the area of these types of devices and services. I'd like to speak in support of Representative Lynn's bill. I think he's done a very good job this morning in laying out the dangers, and I'd like to just point out a few concrete examples that have occurred across the country, in addition to the one that just happened to the congressional representative that we're all familiar with. There was one that occurred where a SWAT team was forced to shut down a neighborhood in New Brunswick, New Jersey, after receiving what they believed was a legitimate distress call. After hours on the scene, it was later determined that through one of these spoofing services, a caller had called in specifically to trick law enforcement into thinking that an emergency was taking place. So I guess we could think back to our days as kids, and occasionally some other kid pulled the fire alarm in school and that caused some disruption. Well, this is obviously far more serious. And specifically, my area is identity theft, and we do already have an example where identity thieves who had purchased stolen credit card numbers called Western Union, and they had set up their caller ID to make it look like the call originated from the legitimate cardholder's name of those stolen credit cards, and then used the credit card numbers and information to conduct cash transfers and literally just move money to their advantage over the phone. There is considerable concern about this in the hand of stalkers, specifically, and you've heard of a letter of support from a women's advocacy group there in Alaska that has occurred at the national level as well in other states that are looking at this, because women are often advised to change phone numbers to protect themselves, get caller ID, use cell phones with caller ID, and to the degree and with the ease with which that caller ID can be deceived through devices and these online services, a woman could think that the call was actually coming from the police or the hospital they had visited or their doctor, when indeed it may be the stalker or someone who means them harm. And I did work as a consultant and expert in a case in New Hampshire where a young woman was murdered by a stalker, not using a spoofing service, but using pretext over the phone to deceive her mother out of her employment information, and the stalker showed up there and killed her. So these spoofing services are just the latest step, if you will, the latest technique, if you will, available to stalkers, identity thieves, and quite frankly are being used in the cases that we are aware of and have been able to investigate across the country by private investigators, by debt collectors, and others, to deceive people into revealing information, thinking they are speaking to someone that they are not. And I'd like to just sort of wrap up by saying at the heart of this is truly consumer protection. There were a number of questions raised by Senator Huggins, I believe, and Senator French, and a few of those I might be able to take a shot at if you toss them my way again here this morning. But at the heart of this is the ability of consumers to trust what has been a very good service for many years now, and that's the caller ID service. And you can still use *67. It may be a different equation in Alaska, I'm not sure, but in most states and nations, *67 to block a call if you do want to remain anonymous, and that's fine because the caller on the other the other end of the call on the caller ID will see, you know, caller ID blocked or restricted or various messages that come up. At least the caller is then, or the recipient of the call is then on notice that they don't know who's on the phone. But when you take it to that extra step to purposely deceive the recipient of the call into believing there's someone else, you've totally destroyed, at its heart, the caller ID system, which at their heart did have consumer protection. I will tell you that just yesterday, a bill was introduced that I played a major role in drafting in the United States Senate. It was introduced on a bipartisan basis by Senator Nelson, Democrat out of Florida, and Senator Snow, Republican out of Maine, and we expect that we'll see significant co-signers on that bill. It was just introduced yesterday morning on the Senate floor. And finally, Florida has an extensive investigation through their Office of the Attorney General of a number of these services, both in this country and one in Canada, to try to answer some of those questions that have been raised here this morning about the volume that these are being used, who's using them, are there other cases of harm out there that we're not aware of? And I think, based on my work over the years, we'll see that there is significant volume. We will find cases of harm when this is opened up, and the serious nature of this will continue to be understood across the country. And finally, I just applaud to entertain any questions you may have.
Questions? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Douglas, for your testimony this morning.
My pleasure.
Anybody else that wanted to testify on the bill in the audience? I didn't see anyone, nor online. None online. We'll close public testimony on the bill. Are there questions, additional questions for the sponsor?
No, sir. I think it's a good bill and request your indulgence with it.
Discussion?
Senator Huggins? Mr. Chairman, I move that CS for House Bill 308 be moved from committee with attached zero physical note and individual comments.
Is there objection? Hearing none, the bill's passed to the next committee of referral, and we'll take a short recess.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we're back on the record. I forgot to mention on the record that Senator Guest and Senator Terrio had joined us shortly after we started. Now we're going to move to 316, and we'll take a look at this CS, and then we'll probably move it again until tomorrow's schedule, but we have before you a draft CS /Yankee. The chair would entertain a motion to adopt this as our working document.
So moved.
Senator Huggins has moved that we adopt /Yankee as our working document. Is there objection? Hearing none, that is our working document. Like to just go through the working document for a moment, and if we look at the title has been changed, and I was just reading the title to make sure I understood it again. The section 1, we've taken section 310 Foxtrot of the bill and rolled into that just to make clear that the portions of the records and files of the Department of Revenue, Department of Natural Resources, Department of Law, and a municipal advisory group established that reflect, incorporate, or analyze information that is relevant to the development of the position or strategy of the Commissioner of Revenue, the Commissioner of Natural Resources, the Attorney General with respect to a particular provision may be incorporated into the contract are
public records after the Commissioner of Revenue gives public notice and of the preliminary findings and determination. This basically just, we just said not until, but we just said they are after. It's not a huge change, but it just makes it a little more understandable for some people who had a question as to when those documents become public records. Of course, the exclusions are there in paragraphs 1, 2, and 3. I think Brian may have given you, did you give them a copy of the public records law?
Yeah.
Just for your review, so that it makes it pretty clear on what are public records under that law. And you'll find that in your packet. Section 2 is just the repeal and reenactment. We've talked about that. Section 3, again, notwithstanding any other provisions of law, a person may not bring an action challenging the findings and determinations relied on by the legislature to authorize the execution of a contract developed under this chapter, the constitutionality of a law authorizing a contract, or the enforceability enacted until that contract has been executed and unless the action is commenced within 120 days. So I think this kind of lays out what we've been talking about. I want the committee to be able to take a look at this as a working document, we'll discuss it in more length tomorrow. Any questions at the moment?
So,
Senator Terrio?
On Section 3, then, the person who does bring an action challenging the findings and determination, would that be the same type of process then as if it were the challenge of the commissioner's findings?
I believe it is. I believe that, well, there it would be an administrative law procedure. This would be a court action to challenge them. And because, as I understand it, now maybe Larry, if you could come up for a second.
So, Mr. Chairman, my question is, in an appeal of an administrative action, you bump up the chain within the department, and then you go to court. So if we have taken out sort of that chain within the department, appealing the decision within the agency, and then go to court, does this court process basically start the same place that you would go to with the administrative?
And introduce yourself for the record, Larry, if you would.
Mr. Chairman, Larry Ostrovsky, Assistant Attorney General, the Oil, Gas, and Mining Section. I've just read this in the last few minutes, so I hate to give an off-the-cuff answer. I do think that 430C is still in the Stranded Gas Act, so I'd have to think about how that plays together with this.
Just a second. Go ahead, Senator French.
Just a point of order for Mr. Ostrovsky. You'll notice that Section 4 of the draft in front of you repeals 430C.
Oh, okay. Yeah. See, that's what happens when you try and answer
right
off the cuff.
Mr. Chairman, then rather today, you just looked at it. I've just really looked at it, even though this was delivered last night, so I can wait till tomorrow.
Yeah, we can do that. And that's kind of why I wanted it to be, give some time to take a look at it. Senator French?
And while Mr. Ostrovsky is doing that, I think, just to give him a heads up, the committee heads up, and whoever may be listening, my chief concern is going to be whether or not the draft in front of us preserves every single substantive right, not a timing right, but a substantive right to challenge the finding. And that's going to be the direction of my inquiry today and tomorrow, just to let you know. Thank you.
And I understand that, and I think the issue there is the issue that we've talked all along, in that the legislature, by inserting itself into the process, is the final screen, so to speak, to the process. And no longer, it was at one time, it was standard procedure at one time, if I understand this correctly, Mr. Ostrowski, that the final finding and determination was the final authorization under law for the commissioner to execute the contract.
That's correct.
Now, no matter what he finds or what his determinations are, there's still another step, and that is that the legislature has to determine whether or not, as part of their determination, whether or not those findings or that the support that this contract would be in the best fiscal interest of the state of Alaska.
That's correct.
But it is no longer the commissioner making that decision. It's now just a recommended. I believe it does. Now we pass the ball to you. Is that right?
I'm sorry, I don't understand. The
commissioner no longer says it's now my decision. I believe it does meet this because here are my findings.
Yes.
But,
well, now I understand.
But they're no longer, in effect, the trigger point where they become the final findings and determination of the division or
that's correct.
Of the department. So therefore, they're no longer a trigger. They're just a pass through.
That's right. A step in the process.
Right. And that's the clumsy part. We have to try to figure out how to deal with that, Senator. That's what I want you to try to figure out.
Thank you, Mr. I'm working on that right now, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Okay. Other questions on this? Okay, we'll put this bill aside until tomorrow morning at 8:30. Senator Terrio,
brief
at ease. We'll take a short recess. Reneva Moss, good to see you. If you'll introduce yourself for the record.
Morning, Mr. Chairman. Reneva Moss, legislative aide for Representative Coghill. And I must tell you that insurance, this is a whole new category for me. This is the Interstate Insurance Product Regulation Act. And this only regulates four types of insurance: life insurance, annuities, disability income, and long-term care products. You're going to see a movement across the country of joining into this compact because the feds are looking at regulating these products. Representative Coghill has agreed to sponsor this piece of legislation to make sure that the state has some input into what these products look like. It establishes a commission that is governed collectively by the states that enter into the compact. Currently, there are 24 states that have joined in. I believe it takes 26 for the compact to be enacted, so it looks fairly certain that this is going to happen this year. There are, I believe, seven other states, and that number could be wrong, that have legislation pending. So it does look like it'll happen this year. As I said, we could be heading for federal regulation of these products if a compact is not created. And this compact is the creature of the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. There was in the House, there was language added that directed the director of insurance to opt out of the commission if the standards adopted are less consumer protective than the state has. And I think Director Linda Hall will tell you that actually the standards that are being adopted by the commission are higher standards than ours. They are more protective. They include a 10-day free look. They include minimum readable readable test and a voluntary mediation. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would defer technical questions to Linda Hall and a representative from the National Association of Insurance Commissioners.
Okay. Are there any questions for Ms. Moss first? Okay. Ms. Hall? Welcome to the Judiciary Committee. And if you'll introduce yourself to the members, we're eager to hear your testimony this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Linda Hall, Director of the Division of Insurance. As the sponsor staff has pointed out, this particular piece of legislation is a model act that was proposed by the National Association of Insurance Commissioners in response to a number of perceived needs. One, a recognition that the financial services marketplace is changing. As the population becomes increasingly mobile, there are products that really are not state-specific. Health insurance, life insurance, annuities are products that people buy and keep for a long time. They're not like an automobile policy that would be really state-specific. There are state-specific conditions at times. There also is a move by certain portions of the insurance industry toward federal regulation. I would hope that it's not that I perceive that as self-serving, but I am a strong supporter of state regulation. I think consumer protections are best done on a state-by-state basis where there's better access to that regulator. The other particular need is speed to market of products. As we see insurance industry competing with other financial services arenas who are not regulated in the same way, it's important to have products that can get to the marketplace to serve consumer needs rapidly. The basic structure of this particular compact is that it would delegate to a commission the authority to develop uniform standards for products. So there would be a uniform filing. Insurance companies could choose to file either in the state or they could choose to file with this commission. And by signing onto this compact, we would allow the companies that write business here to file a product there. The product's standards would be created by this commission. Each state member would have a single vote. In theory, the director, whoever's in this, the chief regulator from the state, would sit on that commission to approve the products, and it takes a two-thirds majority of that particular commission to adopt a product standard. There are ways to opt out of individual standards. Can be done either by the regulator in the state who decides that that standard is not appropriate for the particular state. That has to be done within 10 days, or the legislature can certainly adopt out of any standard that they don't feel meets the needs of their consumers. Where a state does not opt out, approval of the commission is the same as approval by the state. So the commission is delegated the authority to approve a product. Currently, as Ms. Moss pointed out, 24 states have joined this compact. It takes 26 for it to be effective. And as my latest figure, 16 other states are considering adoption. We've talked about the types of products. A couple things that I would point out that as I've watched, and none of the standards will become official until they're actually, the commission is functional, but the things that we're seeing are more stringent than the product standards we have today in Alaska. One of the concerns by regulators around the country was this type of a process would be a race to the bottom. And I think most of us were not interested in that type of a mechanism. I'm interested in consumer protection and product standards. And as I'm seeing those worked on, I'm seeing standards that I think would provide greater consumer protection. So with that, I would be happy to entertain any questions.
Any questions for Ms. Hall? Seeing no questions, thank you, Ms. Hall.
Thank you.
Appreciate your time here with us this morning.
Thank you.
Mr. George, are you in favor of this bill or opposed to the bill, Mr. George?
I'm in favor of it.
Probably don't need to take your time.
Let the record reflect that he put a thumbs up.
Put a thumb up, yes. Thank you, Mr. George. Is there anyone else that wants to testify on the bill this morning? Hearing none, we'll close public testimony. Is there a discussion among the members? I have heard this bill in Labor and Commerce Committee.
Mr. Chairman, I move that CS for House Bill number 439 be moved from committee with individual comments and zero physical vote.
Senator Huggins has moved the bill to the next committee. Is there objection? Hearing none, this bill's moved to its next committee referral, and we wouldn't have got there if Representative Coghill hadn't shown up at the last minute and saved the bill. Short recess. We're back on the record. Next is Senate Bill 307, and before you, you have a new CS identified in the upper right corner as /golf, or G for golf, and the chair would entertain a motion to adopt that as our working document.
So moved.
Senator Huggins has moved /golf as our working document. Is there objection? Seeing none, /golf is adopted. Jane, welcome to the Senate Judiciary Committee, and if you'll introduce yourself for the record, we're eager to hear your introduction this morning.
Good morning, Chairman Seekins and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jane Alberts, and I'm staff to Senator Bundy, who is offering Senate Bill 307 by request of landlords who deal with large numbers of tenants who feel that a ruling in 2002 that changed how they collected rent and late fees has caused consternation among and miscommunication between landlords and renters. What this bill is asking to do is to go back to how landlords used to be able to just send out one notice for rent and late fees. This turned out to be not really quite a simple issue. However, we do have the CS today as an option that is addressing some of the concerns we heard last week in this committee about whether or not there was a cap for the amount a landlord could charge for a late fee. Due to the late hour of getting the CS, I have not had the opportunity to speak to Ed Sniffen or Bob Mayer, who are online, and I'm sure they've been discussing this new CS at the Anchorage LIO as we speak, so it might be good to hear from them.
We do have Mr. Sniffen online. Good morning, Ed. Are you with us?
Good morning, Senator Seekins. Yes, I am.
And if you'll introduce yourself once again to the members, we're eager to hear your comments on the bill.
Yes, thank you. Ed Sniffen with the Department of Law here in Anchorage, and I have reviewed this CS this morning, and by way of just a brief background, in response to a request from Senator French, we being myself and Bob Mayer, have spoke with each other about trying to arrive at a solution that would allow a single notice to tenants to accomplish the the purpose that landlords want to achieve, but at the same time protect consumers from abuses of landlords by trying to shoehorn other fees into a streamlined process that were never really meant to be addressed in that kind of a process. And the best option we came up with was one that would require a fairly significant and substantial rewrite of the Landlord-Tenant Act in Alaska. And given the late hour of this legislative session, we just thought that wouldn't be something we could accomplish this year. The second option we discussed is the one that I think has made it into this CS, and that was to put a cap on the amount that a landlord could charge for a late fee to protect against potential abuses, at least for that item. And we had suggested a 5% cap, 5% of the rental amount. I think the landlord had suggested a 15% cap. The 10% number that's in the current CS was the compromise between those two, and it's not one we're thrilled about. I think 5% is a more reasonable number. I mean, on a $1,000 rental, that would be a $50 late fee. And I guess it's a policy question for this committee to decide if that is enough incentive for renters to pay on time as opposed to a $100 late fee on a $1,000 rental. But anyway, the CS includes this idea that if we legislatively determine that a particular amount of a late fee is reasonable, then that removes a lot of concern for potential landlord abuse. And so with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Sniffen? Senator Guess.
Thank you. I guess I have questions on the work draft. It's still the situation, though, that someone can get evicted solely because they didn't pay their late fees, correct?
Through the chair, Senator Guest, that is, I think, mostly correct. You would actually have to not pay your rent first and to incur the late fee, and then if you cured that defect by paying your rent, but then you were unable to come up with the late fee, then you are correct. The landlord would be able to continue with the eviction process, even though you tried to make good on your rental if you did not pay the late fee.
And either Ed or Jane, do we have in statute when a rent is late? Is it late when it's the first of the month or 10 days after it's due, or do we have?
Through the chair, Senator Guest, that is generally done through the rental agreement with the landlord, and it's set by that contract. So if it's generally rent is due on the first of the month, it's late as soon as it's not paid. But I think most landlords have a 5-day grace period in there that allows you to pay the rent within a certain time period without incurring a late fee. And after that grace period elapses, the late fee is automatically assessed. And I believe that is treated differently from landlord to landlord, but I think that's a common practice.
Okay. So it's not in statute.
That's correct.
Other questions? Senator French.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Sniffen, are there rules and regulations with respect to late fees on, say, mortgage payments, car loans, things like that? Is there anything that caps the size of the late fee in those transactions?
Through the chair, Senator French, that's an excellent question, and I'm familiar with a few of those areas. I know in the mortgage lending arena, there is some federal regulation that control the lending process, and I think some of the limitations are imposed by either federal statute and also by other usury laws, and there's a certain amount of reasonableness that has to be considered as well. In the auto industry, and perhaps the Senator Sheehan would know this one, but I don't believe there is any statutory restriction on when a lender in an auto transaction, for example, can put a cap on a late fee or what kind of a penalty they can charge for non-sufficient fund checks. There's a statutory penalty of no more than, I think, $25. But in all of those scenarios, with the exception of perhaps the mortgage industry, the remedy isn't an eviction. And that's why in this particular case, when you're dealing with generally lower income tenants who can't afford a late fee, it's it's a very harsh reality to be, you know, evicted from your home. If you don't pay your mortgage on time, I think there's, a process that would require somewhere in the order of 30 or 60 days before, you know, you're kicked out. And again, I'm not an expert in that area. If you get a credit card late fee, the most that could happen is your credit limit might be reduced and you go to collections. But the eviction remedy is a fairly severe one, which is why I think it's treated a little more carefully in these statutes.
Other questions for Mr. Sniffen? Yeah, Ed, I really appreciate your taking the time to be with us this morning.
Well, thank you.
We're going to hold this bill over. It's now 9:30, and Jane, we appreciate your being here this morning. We're going to reconvene tomorrow with our regular session at 8:30. We will be looking at this bill and at 316 tomorrow. With that, it's 9:30, and we're adjourned for the day.